Okay, so week two of the thought of Augustine is Augustine on the shape of the soul and the good life. And so when I say the shape of the soul, if you weren't here in the summer, that's one way to say psychology, particularly if you believe in the soul. If you don't, you know, the word psychology doesn't make a whole lot of sense, even if you utter it. So Augustine, really, this is his psychology. It's not the Christian life per se. We're going to do a whole other week on that. But just his reflections as he's first converted, really the first 5-6 years of Augustine's Christian life, where he's reflecting on these things. In our day, Augustine has been accused of being a dualist, and that objection conceives of him as saying many of the same things as the Gnostics said. And there's no doubt that Augustine used the language of Neoplatonism, no question about that. But when we look at this, this is where being biblical means critically and charitably asking ourselves whether or not this or that point is identical to the truths taught by Jesus and the apostles. I'm not so interested in whether or not Augustine used some of the same pieces of imagery. I mean, my goodness, how many sermons open off with illustrations of secular movies? And these same hypocrites will say that Augustine was basically just baptizing Plato in Christianese because he used certain language. The question is, is the idea that he's communicating consistent with the Bible? And more importantly, does it teach something that's taught centrally in the Bible? That should be our real question. So on the board here, you have from left to right our 4 points: the shape of the soul, the objects of eternity, the objective good of the soul, and the subjective means toward that end. I don't want to assume anything. When I say objective, oh, you see that chart over there? I don't know if you can see it. But the object, in philosophical language, the object is the thing known, and the subject is the knower. So this is just the classical, Western, and biblical view of truth, that truth is objective. Truth is what it is outside of me. My job is to conform to the truth. The truth is not whatever I want it to be, or whatever I like it to be, and stuff like that. The truth is, in my mind, the knowing agent, the subject, is to conform to it. So it's not object versus subject, like the subject's bad. It just means that our subjective life is supposed to be conformed to the way that God really is and the way that He set up His world. So that's what that language means. The big idea is that Augustine's doctrine of the soul's essence and the soul's good are in the main consistent with the biblical doctrine. Now I add in the main because, of course, we're not going to agree with everything that any, you know, extra biblical thinker says, but in the main just means in his main points, in the substance of what he's saying, his view of the soul's essence and the soul's good, in other words, the end of the soul, what the soul is doing, what it's made for, those ideas are consistent with the biblical doctrine of the soul's essence and the soul's good. Okay, so that's the big idea. Just keep coming back to that if you get lost at any point. That's what we're trying to show. The earliest writings of Augustine, both before and after conversion to Christ, revolved around the relationship between the proper objects of the mind and the proper function of the soul. And there's going to be a connection between them, the object of the mind and the function of the soul. Think of it this way. The object of the mind is going to be like the fuel, even though it's not in his mind. In beholding that object, to the degree that it's there, it begins to shape the soul, fuel the soul, so that the rest of the faculties of the soul follow the engine like the freight cars and the caboose. You get the idea. It's driven toward the object. So you have all the causes here proper to the soul. Okay, so he's going to actually argue that there's a proper object. Well, this works whether you're fixed on the proper object or an improper object. It's going to work the same way. What you behold is going to shape you. But to the degree that it's the proper object of the soul, the rest of your soul is going to become in conformity to that object. On that point, he agrees, or I should say it like this, the pagan philosophers even got some of that stuff right. And it's here where we can see the clearest parallels between the Neoplatonic influence on the pre-converted professor of rhetoric, and the clearest lines of demarcation between those things that were just Plato and those things where Augustine, as he was reading Paul, as he was reading his letters, started to correct Plato and filter him through a biblical lens. And while we're at it, it's also in this subject where we can separate the novice from the serious student of Augustine. It's typical of philosophical shoppers, philosophical lightweights, and it's also typical of hyper-spiritual anti-intellectualists to get the idea, when we're contemplating these things, that the Bishop of Hippo was nothing but a baptizer of the universalizing Platonic worldview. And what each party who says this means is going to differ depending on who they are. There's skeptics that'll say this. And there's pietists who will say this. In other words, those who are disbelievers in the faith and fancy themselves as professionals at it. And then pietists, those that reduce the Christian faith to individual feelings and good deeds. So piety, which is good, becomes a whole epistemology. You reduce the whole Christian faith to me, myself, and I. Except you make it feelings and good works to change the subject from the fact that you've reduced it to yourself. Okay? So different parties are going to mean something different by this critique of Augustine. The skeptic will say that Augustine was just baptizing Plato so as to point to Augustine's lack of originality and therefore his lack of philosophical credentials. If you read Bertrand Russell's History of Philosophy or Will Durant's History of Philosophy, you will not see Augustine have a chapter devoted to him. You go right from Aristotle to Francis Bacon. Now, why is that? There's a bias there. It's that Christian thinkers weren't philosophers. Now, the pietist will say this so as to point to Augustine's compromise with the classical pagan and therefore his subjection of revelation to unaided human reason. Which authors do that today? My response is, find me an author who doesn't. Find me a Christian author who is capable of reading Augustine without doing that. And I will eat that book. I'll pour a little chocolate on it, but I will eat part of the page. That's my dare. Homework assignment. Even the great Gordon Clark does it. It's embarrassing. Spohr doesn't do that. Good for him. He doesn't see him as a rationalist. We'll get into this. But both parties show themselves to be as uncharitable in their reading as they are undiscerning in their logic. First point, the shape of the soul. This is Augustine's shape of the soul. Let me erase this. Give you a little bit of drawing in each of the four sections. The soul has an invisible shape. An invisible shape. And by the way, while we're at it, the soul is superior to the body, which doesn't mean it can get on very well without it. That's another way to read them. And maybe Augustine, at the heights of his wanting to get alone with his books, I suppose, can be taken that way. And I'm not going to defend his every last syllable. But the soul does have an invisible shape, and that shape of the soul is more excellent than the body. That's just part of the biblical worldview. Everybody talked like that. Calvin devoted a lot of pages in the Institutes to that. Now, Augustine has to start in his thinking somewhere. Even a great thinker has to go backwards, in a sense, when you become converted to Christ. You have to clear the board, go back to the drawing board. And so 387 was that year after he was converted. And one last piece of interesting backdrop. After Monica's death that year, after he was converted, Augustine returned home to Thagaste, so northern Africa, next to Hippo, which is next to Carthage. He returned back there with his intellectual friends, and he spent part of the previous year studying monastic life in Rome and reading the Psalms. If you want to know what Augustine was doing in that year, 387, he was studying monastic life in Rome and reading the Psalms. He was retiring a little bit from his being professor of rhetoric, and he was studying those things, and that was foundational because the Augustinian order of monastic life comes out of these reflections. And who does that influence? Well, Luther, you might remember, was a monk, and which order was he in? He was in the Augustinian order. In 387, Augustine wrote a book, the Soliloquies, which I'm actually going to refer to more than other books today. And he writes that in 387. And it's interesting, very interesting. It's a brief tract, but it's in the form of a dialogue between Augustine the seeker and the reason that's now residing in him. So he prays a lengthy prayer at the beginning and at other points, but then the rest of it is reason saying something, Augustine saying something back, seeking, reason answering him, and so on. It's this back and forth. You think, wow, he's weird. He's talking to himself. He hears voices. But it's his reason and Augustine the seeker having this conversation. About what? About God and the soul. About the good life. About the shape of the soul. And he writes other books during this time on the good life, a book on evil in the world, and a book that criticizes all the contemporary liberal art schools. And all these books have something in common. They have a synergy. And that's the attempt to match up the inner life of the mind to the objective symmetry of the real world, and ultimately its author. So, what Augustine sees so far is that the soul has a shape. Now, I'm using that, I hope you realize, loosely. So I'll put shape in quotes. It's an invisible shape. If you want to use the word form, use the word form. And you might remember from last time we briefly mentioned this idea of the forms of Plato. But let's erase that S, because one of the things we're going to see is that ultimately this is God in eternity shaping everything else. How does he do that? Well, this invisible shape is an intellectual shape. Not because everything in the soul is intellect, but because what shapes the soul is fundamentally intellectual. And so think of the word information. How does anything in this universe take the form that it does? It is a result of information, which is fundamentally invisible. By an eternal form going in, you are informed and therefore transformed. Now, there's two different forms. That's the problem. Romans 12:2. Don't be conformed. What does that mean in the Latin? With. Think of go with the flow. As opposed to transform. What does that mean in the Latin? It's meta in the Greek. Above and beyond form. So a form above and beyond you is metamorphote in the Greek in that verse, and also in 2 Corinthians 3:18, metamorphose. Where do we get the English word metamorphosis? What happens when you metamorphosize? Is that a word? When you experience a metamorphosis, what happens? You change from one degree to another. Where does it come from? Does it come from inside or outside? Well, if you were in the 19th century and back, a simple-minded Darwinist, suppose it could come from the inside, but what do we now know? Information. Where does that come from? From a mind. From the outside. From beyond. That's transformation. Well, Augustine realized that this was true, certainly about the soul. So the invisible soul is shaped or formed by the invisible shapes or forms of eternity. The order of truth determines the order of the soul, or, to say it another way, what we behold begins to shape us. And I mentioned Romans 12:2, 2 Corinthians 3:18. But add to that 2 Corinthians 4:6, where God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shown in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And that's original regeneration. 2 Corinthians 3:18 talks about that happening day after day. By beholding that same image, we're transformed into that image. And then 1 John 3:2, add one more verse. 1 John 3:2, we know that we will be like him when we see him. Sorry, we know that we will be like him on that day because we will see him as he is. So there's metamorphosis all at once. Because we see him as he is, we will be, boom, what Paul says in 2 Corinthians happens day after day after day, little by little, from one degree of glory to another. John says happens, boom, all together at once, radically changing us, but it's the same beholding. What we behold shapes us. What we look at, the thing we look at, becomes what we become, or we become what we look at. When Augustine closes his extended prayer at the beginning of this book, The Soliloquies, he is asked what he would know as a seeker, to which he responds, God and the soul. Augustine inherits the classical distinction between man and beast by reason. That's not something that simply Aristotle made up. That's a biblical idea that what distinguishes man and beast is reason. Now, in the Christian view, you have a more full-orbed view of what that means. But it doesn't mean less than that. But Augustine also inherits the moral evaluation that comes with it. So think about this. There's a moral dimension or a moral consequence to man being higher than animal, which is why we tell our kids, hey, stop acting like an animal. Why? I don't have any problem with animals. That's why we go to the zoo. That's why we have pets. I have a problem with you acting like an animal because you're not one. You're better than that. Here's the moral consequence. Men are higher than beasts by reason. But there's a flip side to that. They're lower than beasts if they abuse their reason. They don't simply descend to animals because I don't blame a cat for following its tail around. It can do nothing better than that. I do blame a human for doing that because they are meant for something higher. So we are actually lower than beasts. We become like demons if we don't use our reason. Augustine said it like this in the Soliloquies in part 7. He says, men are my friends and I love them, not in that they are animals, but in that they are men. That is, in that they are animated by rational souls, which I love even in highwaymen. For I may with good right in any man love reason, even though I rightly hate him who uses ill that which I love. Therefore I love my friends the more worthily they use their rational soul. Or certainly, the more earnestly they desire to use it worthily. So Augustine even makes an allowance there. It's not an IQ issue. It's, do you love seeing that which you were made to see? It's a moral issue. His point is this. You know a friend better when you know the invisible form of him. Isn't that true? If you really know someone, is it because you know how good looking they are? Or because of how well they can play basketball? Or because of how healthy they are? And those things may say something about their character, but when do you really know someone? You know the person, which is invisible. One even knows a physical object better as its invisible properties are known. For all of physical properties are entirely reducible to the formal, whether of math, language, or logic. And therefore, there is nothing whatsoever that is not known better by being known in its eternal essence. Not an example of it. If I say, what is that? Doesn't matter what it is. And you point to the thing, you're showing me an example of that thing. Not the essence of that thing. That's why we have dictionaries. And in that dictionary, they don't take a, you know, you ever hear that phrase, if you looked up such and such in the dictionary, they'd see your picture. Actually, that's never the case. Because it's always an example and not the essence of the thing. Here's the point on this first point. Information that shapes souls, the essence of things, is invisible. And so the soul is that to copy God. That's why man is more like God than anything else in the created order. And it is the highest thing we mean when we mean that man was made in God's image, is that reason which looks beyond itself. You know, no other creature in all of creation can willingly look outside of itself and therefore willingly refuse to look outside of itself too. And so we are more like angels and demons than anything else in the created order. The objects of eternity. The objects of eternity. This is where we're going to go from Plato's doctrine of the forms to medieval realism. And Augustine really stands in the middle of that idea. And so we have to see what the forms are, because when we see what they are and we see how Augustine handles them, we're going to see the crystallization, or the, at least the beginning of this doctrine that is the main philosophical doctrine in the Middle Ages, and it is the correct doctrine, as we vaguely hinted at last week, called realism. Here's what it means basically, and I'll start by making this claim. Let me write this on the board, this claim. Universals are as necessary as God because God is all eternal being. Let's put that together. First of all, the universals are as necessary as God. Let me just leave it like that for a second, dot, dot, dot. Stop there. Analyze that. Let it sink in. If I said, Now, object when you hear the fallacy. If I said that about anything else in creation, you'd go, your brain would be going up in smoke right now. Who caught it? Say it again. If I said this about anything else in creation, yeah. Nominalism is the opposite view. It says that these things, justice, beauty, redness, oneness, over-there-ness, so on, those are just names. Nomen is the Latin for name. Those are just useful names that we give to things. But those aren't real things. Realism says that everything is entirely made up of only two things, attributes of God and things beheld in the mind of God that are eternally the case. And if that is not true, then no sentence uttered by any human about anything is true. Not a single syllable has any meaning, no objective meaning, if words are just useful names that we came up with that don't correspond to real being. Realism says that universals, in other words, predicates, that's the way it's going to work out linguistically, are real things that have always been true. They mean something before they are instanced, instantiated is the word philosophers use, or else there'd be no meaning whatsoever to any word about anything. Okay? Why is this doctrine attacked? Because it proves theism, and the opposite is atheism. And that's what the battle's really about, not about some philosophical battle. Universals are as necessary as God. Here's the second part of my claim. Where is it? There to go. I know it's because. Okay. Because God is all eternal being. Because, so it's going to, this is going to mean the same thing. God is all eternal being. So, if it is eternal being, in other words, if it's immutable, it's something in God. Or it's not immutable. You may, you know, sometimes we say, the immutable laws of physics. The immutable laws of baseball. If we really want to get, chummy about it and talk about something, you know, regular going on, sometimes, well, I can't remember the example I was thinking about, but the immutable something rather. Sometimes we'll say that about something that's really not immutable.
Carl Sagan?
No. Got to think of. Oh, yeah, always there. Yeah. Yeah, that the cosmos is all there is, or all there ever was, or all there ever will be. So sometimes we'll, that's one example, immutability. Okay? But you could say infinite. Okay, so, oh, that's infinite. Yes, it is. You've got some choices to make now. Okay? The laws of logic, they are, they're invisible, they're immaterial, and they couldn't have been otherwise. They're necessary. Yes, they are. So you've got some choices to make. Okay? If you're not a polytheist, and you find other things that have eternal characteristics, you've got some choices to make in your worldview. With the Platonists, the Augustinians agreed that universals must exist eternally in order for any human utterance to make any objective sense. So there is an agreement between Augustine and Plato there. But against the Platonists, Augustine added that such universals were one of two things, either attributes of God or thoughts beheld in the mind of God. And that laid the foundation for philosophical realism in the Middle Ages. So, realism in a biblical worldview are either, universals are either attributes of God, justice, love, perfection, or things necessarily beheld in the mind of God. One of those two things. Why is this important? Well, there's a caricature of what realism is, but it's based on something that really was taught by Plato. I call this the pins at the carnival approach to doing philosophy. You knock down the Plato pin, you get your teddy bear, and you say, ha-ha, there's no such thing as realism. Well, maybe you just have no imagination and you're really lazy. Could it be that Plato was right about this, but he applied it to wrong things? And that maybe you've knocked down the Plato pin, but we're not really defending Plato. Why do you care about that? Didn't you care about truth? Okay? So, here's where Plato taught that. Two places, really, but in the sixth book of Plato's Republic, this really shows the dead end of pagan forms. What he did was he came up with this analogy for his forms. And it was kind of like a sun in the middle of a solar system. He had already shown, I think convincingly to Christians, that all these things down here, if you say this is just, this is unjust, and if I come up to you and say, well, what makes that just and that unjust? And I think a good beginner's dialogue of Plato is the Euthyphro, because there you have this young man who's going to the courtroom to convict his father for doing something. Socrates runs into him and says, what are you doing there? And he says, well, I'm going to convict my father. Oh, man, that's horrible. Is that... How do you know it's the right thing to do? He says, what is justice? The conversation turns to him. He says, well, justice is what I'm doing right now. Justice, well, that may be an instance of justice, but what makes that just? And they say, well, justice is what all the gods love. Well, some of the gods disagree with other gods. Well, there's some things in which all the gods, and so on and so on and so on, until he comes back and he argues in a circle and he gets the guy Euthyphro to realize, well, I have no earthly idea what justice is. Get out of my way, Socrates. I'm going to commit justice. And Christians can look at that and say, yes, Plato's right. There has to be something called the just, or justice, without which these things down here would have no meaning. There has to be a standard that is eternal, immutable, unchanging, true in all cases, over all agents at all times, and so on. Anyway, fast forward. Plato shows truth, justice, goodness, beauty, oneness, you name it. It's in there. But he said, what holds them together? He calls it the good, because he has to show that the good life, the life of the philosopher, is driven towards some ultimate good, because everybody knew that. Everybody, you do what you do to ultimately to seek happiness. Okay, and so the invisible part of the soul, beholding that thing that is most invisibly excellent, and he didn't realize it's all one thing. Plato is right under his nose and he doesn't see it. Well, in another one of his dialogues, the Timaeus, he has something of a creation myth. And he, because the one dilemma in this philosophy was, okay, how did this become this? How did this become the cause of this? And that's really the chief criticism that his student Aristotle laid at him and started to depart from Plato's system. Because where's the causal power? How did this issue forth into this world of appearances? So Plato said, well, there's this demiurgos is the Greek word. It's a kind of god, but it's an under-creator, because here's what he has to do. He's going to make a perfect world, which is imperfect. It doesn't really jive, but he's got a perfect thing to look at. He's got a perfect blueprint in this world of the forms. So they have this architect, workman, craftsman, I guess is the literal Greek meaning of demiurgos, and he looks at this perfect blueprint, and he makes the world based on that. Now, Jonathan Edwards would draw a big circle around this and say, you're right about that. He did look at the perfect image in himself, his son. But Plato didn't see that, because he's not a Christian. And so he had God looking outside of himself, which implies that there's something superior to himself, exerting a causal power over himself. And Aristotle realized that won't work. Aristotle didn't have a better solution, but he realized that that wouldn't work. But at any rate, this is a chief problem of Plato's philosophy. But not for Augustine, because he's a Christian. For Augustine, God alone is eternal substance, so that all universals are a particular, a real thing, a substance, which then has a nature with causal power. And therefore, God can create the world based on a perfect blueprint by looking at himself and then affecting everything else. And so all universals are a particular in the Christian worldview, a real thing, the supreme particular being. And in this way, Plato is corrected by Paul first in his letter to Rome. In Romans chapter 1, verse 20,
All right, Matt, this is all cute, but does the Bible teach realism?
Yes! Romans 1:20, thanks for asking. Romans 1:20 says this, "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." So what did you just hear?
Things of God, not just useful names in these things, but they, these things, clearly seen in the things that have been made. How many of the things that have been made? All of them, no exceptions. Oh yeah, give me a verse for that. Psalm 19, 1 through 3.
There is no speech, no voice where his words are not heard, where his speech is not heard. So the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies above proclaim his handiwork. Day to day pour forth speech, night to night reveal knowledge. There is no voice. In other words, there's nothing in the creation that is not speaking, reflecting this light. How far do you want to take that? Jeez, I mean, every single predicate of every sentence is ultimately a thing about God. Yep. Yes. And when you start to play with that idea and pull that thread and reject that, that thread is connected to the whole other ball of yarn. And you will wind up in atheism to the degree that we depart from realism. And the medieval thinkers understood that. That's another class. But here's the thing. The things of eternity, in the things of time. Or to say it another way, the divine attributes causing particular effects. In other words, the rose in its redness, a boy in his courage. Ultimately, it's not its redness and it's not his courage, but they are participating in being. And so Plato would use this pair, which Augustine agreed with. And the medieval thinkers agreed with this, that you had two basic things in reality. Being, which belongs to God alone, and participation in being. It's kind of like sun and sunlight versus the reflection of light on things, that you see the color comes to your eyes and stuff like that. Now, that's a vague analogy because there's still wood there without the light hitting you in a dark room. So it's an analogy. But the idea is that everything in the created order, pick an attribute of any particular thing, doesn't matter what attribute, is a thing that if you took it away from that thing, would exist without that thing. So here's a purple ball. I burn the ball in the fire, make all of its ashes go into oblivion. Does purple still exist? Of course it does. So does roundness, and bounciness, and rubberness, and over-there-ness, and everything else you can possibly think of, no exception. In other words, nothing exists except for God and everything that God is upholding by His Word. And those things that He's upholding by His Word are things entirely about Him. You get the idea that everything besides God is pretty small. This is why people hate Augustine and Calvin and Edwards. They're actually taking the Bible seriously. And if you leave this picture, then you begin to have, if you have a second being with the power of being, if you have a second story, a second thing, a parallel track, you've got dualism. Then you have dualism. Here's the irony. If you don't think like Augustine, you're a dualist. And today we accuse Augustine of being a dualist. How perverse. How backwards. So Augustine allows that guys like Plato and then Plotinus, the main Neoplatonist thinker in the century before him, they stumbled on these truths. But he adds that, quote, many copiously utter what they do not know. Many copiously utter, they studied it hard, they've landed on something, but they don't really know what they're looking at. Does this sound like a guy who's baptizing Plato? Or a guy who's giving Plato a good spanking? The order of truth presented must mirror reality. I gave you another picture there, and sorry, it's very small. I swore that was really clear on my word doc there, but it's really not clear here on this paper. But here, all it is this. Plato's idea of the forms, where you have the highest being up here, in other words, the most objective thing, the form or the essence. By the way, when a Platonist uses the word form, they mean the same thing as idea. They mean the same thing as the essence of the thing. Okay, so those are all synonyms. The more you get down here into the world of appearances, the circumstances, the way the deck is shuffled at any particular point in the space-time continuum, It's becoming more and more subjective. In other words, more and more of a perspective rather than the truth of the way things are. But the order of truth has to mirror the order of reality in everything, in our education system, in everything. And this order is objective, but it also has to be hierarchical. There's a big word, but and not a very nice word either. Hierarchy. If I say that something is, well, let me say it like this. If I say that reality is hierarchical, what am I saying? Or hierarchy. Or just what is a hierarchy? Any hierarchy. Yeah, totem pole. There's a head. Yeah, there's head, RK.
Somewhere higher than us.
Think of it that way. Okay, so the Greek word RK. Okay, you have a highest head. You have a head.
Now the Neoplatonists called it the one.
It gets mystical and stuff like that. Forget about that. We're not talking about them. We're talking about the big biblical worldview. Is reality a hierarchy? This is what Christians do. They say, well, God's a hierarchy. He's the creator. And he set up a few hierarchies. So you have this picture thinking. C.S. Lewis said we're guilty of picture thinking. Sure, reality's hierarchy. But what we mean by that is this circle up here and a couple of circles in here. And then we have all this space that's not really hierarchical. And we don't say that, but we picture think. And that's our default. And we find all this neutral territory that doesn't run like that. In Augustine's thinking, since monism is false, in other words, since the idea that all is one, and none of these guys are monists right here, but the Eastern world is. So monism is that all is one, so you have pantheism, all is God, or panentheism, all is an extension of God or a part of God. If that's false, and it is, then you have a diversity of things. But if you have a diversity of things, and you have effects, then you have causes. And if every effect has a cause, and it follows by resistless logic, there's a hierarchy of causes, and consequently a hierarchy of beings that did the causing. Now, if there's a hierarchy of being, and if all truth is of being, about being, then it follows that there's a hierarchy of truth, so you follow that. If there's a hierarchy of being, and truth is about being, then there's a hierarchy of truth. Some truths are more necessary than others. I wouldn't say some truths are truer than others. If something's true, it's true. But some truths are more necessary than others because the being that they're about is more necessary than other beings. Okay? That there is unchanging being is absolutely necessary. That I held onto this piece of chalk for the remainder of this class, it's possible. And if I pull it off, turns out it'll be a necessary truth in the mind of God. But for our purposes, in a changeable world, it is not a necessary truth. God did not have to allow me to pull that off. He can knock it out of my hands anytime he wants to. It's not a necessary being. Augustine did not get this notion of a hierarchy of being from Porphyry's scale of being or his Trebe diagram. He's another Neoplatonist. He got it from reasoning about this very thing within biblical categories. He was distancing himself from all non-Christian thought systems. The prevailing academic method was simply to suspend judgment his time. In other words, it was a form of philosophical skepticism that Augustine had to do battle with. Another very important part of Augustine's philosophy of the objects of eternity was his view of words. Augustine came up with a language theory that I'm going to get more into from his book on Christian doctrine. When we get to Augustine's view on Scripture, I'm going to go into detail on this and why it's practical. But we'll just introduce it a little bit here. I'll do it over here. And you find the roots of it in a book called De Magistro, or The Teacher. Ideas stand over words. Because, and actually, yeah, I'll do that. Because there are real things or objects that hopefully the words represent. Now, just look at that for a second. Can you see how if I messed up with that order, that I'd have something more relativistic or subjective? Hopefully, these are symbols, which the moment you say symbols, you're dealing with an idea. You're not just dealing with ink patterns. You're saying that, what does that mean? Well, it means what it says. Well, what do you mean by that? And whatever I mean by it, and even it means what it says, means something other than the ink patterns. You're meaning something about something. Okay? And if you mess with that order, you will have relativism, even if you don't mean to. Ideas stand over words as the thing signified to the sign. Words, apart from their intended meaning, become word games. We might be helped by things like facial expressions and tones and context and so forth, but nothing will help us if we divorce the symbol from the objective substance. And the reason that this matters to the whole of our worldview is that the soul has to love the ultimate substance of experience and communication, and not just play word games with people and things and ideas. You have to love the truth. You have to mean getting the meaning, or else it'll descend to the basest use of truth. Chadwick says in his book, Augustine, a short introduction, he says, quote, "Augustine was the last person to deny that words are useful, but it does not follow that words can in themselves be effective or adequate for conveying full meaning in matters of great weight. Truth is ultimately communicated through an intangible, inaudible, and I don't like this, indescribable." That's a problem, and that shows that this author is getting a little bit away from Augustine's meaning. "But inaudible experience of the interaction of mind with mind. For mind can be known only by mind." So he's not devaluing words there, but words are communicating being. Thirdly, the objective good of the soul. If this is reality, and our soul was made to conform to God's reality, well then now we're going to set up the process. The soul moving that way, and then how do you get there? So here's the sense in which the soul is made for something higher than itself. That's going to take mind. And this is, how does the mind get there? Okay? Sort of a how-to. The objective good of the soul. The ordering of the soul follows from the ordering of truth, as the finite soul was made for the infinite truth. God is proper to the mind because no good thing is found outside of his eternal essence. Augustine calls God at this point the blessedness, quote, "the intelligible light in whom and from whom and through whom all things intelligibly shine." Well, that's, where did he get that? He got it from Romans 11:36. "For from him and through him and to him are all things." Well, if that's true about all things, then God's illumination of those things, because truth is about reality. Okay? So all truth is from him and through him and to him. Think back to Plato's sun in the solar system of forms, the good. And if the soul is working well, if the soul was made for an eternal good, and if there is a most essential eternal being, then this object perceived as truly good will be conceived as all satisfying to the soul. Such an object will form a sufficient cause for all human action, an end cause. Now, this is true, again, the principle is true for believer and unbeliever. Now, you can be wrong about what you think will most satisfy your soul, but here's the principle. Three basic, the flow chart, I guess you could say, to Augustine's psychology. An objective psychology will look like this. The soul beholds an ultimate object. You may be wrong about what that ultimate object is, and so Josh just talked about idols, but idols do have this power because you're convinced that it is ultimate. If you're wrong, it still follows that your soul will follow. From ultimate objects come an ultimate value. If you are persuaded that that thing is the biggest thing, you will be persuaded that it will most satisfy you, or most threaten you, kind of a carrot and stick thing. You will either supremely pursue it, or you will supremely fear it. But ultimate object immediately issues forth into ultimate value. Worldview makes everything. The church is trying to eradicate it. It's everything. From ultimate value comes ultimate motion. This is what you call the end cause, the reason for which I did something. Ultimate motion. If I fear it, above all else, I will move away from it, regardless of how that situates all else. I will hold everything else hostage for this irrational fear. If I'm convinced that it will please me, I will move heaven and earth to get that particular thing, even if it's not the ultimate good. But that's the flow. Whether we are rationally right about that value, or whether we are being irrational. The question for Augustine was whether or not the particular individual soul is correct about that object perceived as supremely valuable. Now, three things follow from there being such an ultimate object, which alone explains the intelligibility of other objects. Three things follow from there being that sun. So let's remember that analogy of the sun that Plato used and that Augustine is borrowing from. Augustine is actually going to start to form an epistemology that's biblical. We've already seen he got it from Romans 1:20. So he's correcting Plato, saying three things follow about there being such an ultimate object. Number one, that he is, so this is the sun. Number two, that he shines. And number three, that he illuminates. So let's put a world here with a tree, I guess. And, a mountain and a guy on the mountain. There you go. Okay? Three, that he illuminates. I'm going to put reflection from the guy from the side of the mountain, and this will be so I'll put shading here, this will be the light side of the tree, just to signify that it's a reflection or an illumination, so lighting up other things. That he is, that he shines, that he illuminates. Or, he goes on to say, that he is apprehended, and that he makes other things to be apprehended. That he is apprehended, and that he makes other things to be apprehended. So whether we're reasoning about God or reasoning about other things, our reason is always the lighting up of revelation. And again, we're starting to see how we can clearly show that Clark is wrong, that Augustine was a rationalist, that he sought for any reason outside of revelation. Now, the modern world would likely object to Augustine at this point, as far as pleasure. So what does this have to do? What does epistemology have to do with pleasure seeking? My goodness. Seems to me that if I use big words like epistemology, I'm going to be in the nut house. How is epistemology related to me living the good life? How does intellectual contemplation alone, straw man, watch it, alone satisfy the soul, or how does any purely formal object, straw man, watch it, how does any purely formal object satisfy that which experiences pleasure in a human being? Well, Augustine would surely reply that there's two false premises loaded into that objection. And it's combined in one. First of all, you might be assuming that this contemplation must remain alone. You mean I have to think about God? Why, the children will die. Who says that? Have you been to the Christian bookstore? Everybody. I mean, I feel the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches being extracted from the little kid's hand every time I read a systematic theology textbook. Evil. Secondly, you might be assuming that if the supreme object is immaterial or intelligible, that it cannot go together with other dimensions of personality and personal relationship. You're thinking about me? Don't you know I just want to be loved? Who wants to be loved? You or somebody else? Stop thinking about things. You're separating things that were not meant to be separated. Why should we accept either one of these premises? This is a unity. My mind and my affections and my volition, my will, is a unity. These aren't three different flavors to three different kinds of Christians or three different human races. Our souls are a unity. Irony of ironies, there it is again. Augustine has a unified soul. It is the critic of Augustine today that's the dualist or the pluralist or the one who would split apart the soul and compartmentalize these parts of life that God has meant to be put together. If you want to have a good time, then think. If you want to be good for people, then read books and get out of this age in which people are dying so that you can come back into this age as a liberator. A reading of the Confessions will show that Augustine is speaking directly to God. He's using the language of prayer. He's using the language of the psalmist. And no wonder, because he spent that whole year in 387 reading the Psalms. In summary, we could say two things, and this is going to be crucial as we move to that last point. Because you're going to read a lot of other things about Augustine that will make you think, and I should really probably draw this last picture over here, except you might not see it, so I'll draw it really big. Two things I'm going to show. I'm going to show, number one, Augustine's head, that's going to be number one, and it's going to be lining up to number one up here, God. The way God is, I'm drawn to that. I'm drawn to God by thinking, in his hand is going to be a knife. And that knife is so sharp that it cuts that piece of chalk. That knife is going to cut things down here. It's going to sacrifice. It's going to represent self-sacrifice, or think of that verse in Hebrews, which is the extreme. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Or how did Jesus say it in the Sermon on the Mount? If your right eye causes you to sin, cut it out. Or if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. That's pretty violent. Okay, but see, if you take that out of context, Jesus hates eyes. He hates right hand, and Augustine was approved. Okay, context, context, context. So number two is going to follow very conveniently, just like in math, from number one. Okay? And so the cutting is going to be, man, this thing doesn't go together with this thing. I've got to have this thing so this doesn't go together with this thing. You know, I don't know if it was you or if it was Hannah, but one of you liked peas when you were younger, when you were a baby. Really liked peas, and I didn't understand that because peas to me remind me of frog eyeballs or something. I don't understand that. It's disgusting. But then you discovered ice cream, pizza, bones, filthy, rotten. One second. So how did you kick your habit of peas? By the way, I'm not telling my son not to eat vegetables. Don't get the wrong idea there. There's other vegetables that are good. But how did you kick the habit? You found something more delightful. I remember the day that I was watching the Super Bowl. And it was 2003, I think. And I was reading a C.S. Lewis book in one hand, and I was watching the game in the other. It was one of those years that nobody was over. There was no Buffalo Wings. There was no real other reason to watch the game other than it was the game, and it was habit, and it's what I did. If you had told me when I was 15 years old, stop watching that Super Bowl game, don't you know that football is of the devil? I would have said, really, come on. There's a lot of things that are of the devil, but I'm pretty sure that the Super Bowl is not one of those things. Come on. But I was looking back and forth, the game and the book, and so I turned the volume down so I could read the book and still catch the game. And then eventually I said, this is too distracting, and I turned the whole thing off altogether so I could read C.S. Lewis. Why did I do that? Was it because somebody came up to me and said, it's been 10 years and you still don't realize that football is of the devil? No, it's because I found a higher pleasure. And this thing was incompatible or slowing me down from my higher pleasure. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is John Piper is not the first person to ever come up with Christian hedonism. It's been there before. So, two truths follow from everything we've said. Two truths. First, that which is most excellent outside of us calls out that which is most excellent inside of us. So the part of us that's most like God, namely the intellect. What? Oh, I feel the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches leaving the children's hands again. No, the part of us that is most like, our fingers? You think our fingers are most like God? You help me understand what our feelings. Okay, we'll get to that. And God does have feelings. We'll get to that. But that which is most excellent outside of us calls out that which is most excellent inside of us. Why would our intellect most directly point to God? What do you do when you're thinking? Well, you could think of yourself and nothing but yourself, and that's called narcissism. But in general, the part of you that looks outside of you has to look. Your mind is the thing which gets you over yourself. What? I thought I silenced it. I'm sorry. I don't even have any real response to this. Oh, yeah, the silence button. That's right, the silence button. Silence button. I think if I hold it, nope. Come on, sorry. This is really embarrassing. Power off. Yeah. I will make this point. It is the last thing I do. If that's true, if that which is most excellent outside of us calls out that which is most excellent inside of us, second point, number two, that which is subservient to the most excellent must be subdued precisely by that which is most excellent. Why is there sacrifice? Ultimate joy. Ultimate value. If you look at Jesus' statements in the Gospel, you'll see the same thing. I won't make the argument. Listen to Piper's sermons. He does a good job of it. That's what sacrifice is. It is not as an end in itself. If it were, it would draw attention to you, the sacrificer, and not the thing to be gained. Much of what Augustine shuns in this life is more a subordination of lesser goods to the supremely good, rather than a rejection of the thing as evil altogether. So he says, and this is going to sound sexist at first, but just get the drift. He's attacking this stance of the man toward the woman, not the woman herself. So let me just say that right up front. So it says, quote, "Nothing more saps the citadel of manly strength, whether of mind or body, than female blandishments or familiarities," end quote. Solomon's mother, Lemuel's mother in Proverbs 31 just said the same thing. But then she went on to say, go after this woman, son, which tells you she wasn't being a sexist. She was saying, don't waste your kingly vocation on women. Not because women are the problem, but because your pleasure-seeking instrument is the problem right now. She mentions wine, too. She mentions wine, too. What does Luther say? Men can go wrong with wine or women. Should we get rid of women? He's talking about wine and whether or not we should drink wine. Okay, so the same thing's going on here. He's attacking there our second-rate pleasure-seeking. The things, the occasions... See, he applies the same logic to food or leisure or positions. All are good. None are bad. Except to the exact degree that they form a spiritual friction against our taking heaven by storm. So he applies it to everybody, men and women. He's just saying, these things that God made good, if our soul is not pointed with the intellect up toward God, any of them can become a spiritual friction against our taking heaven by storm. So he reflects that when he sought love and honors and wealth, it was for their own sake. And they're an end. A corruptible, finite satisfaction of the soul. So it wasn't satisfying at all. He says, quote, "Yet if I cannot accept through these, find a passage to those things which I in effect really desire, I do not pursue them as things to be embraced, but accept them as things to be allowed." So, end quote, he's allowing them. But he's saying if they are not instruments through which you know God more, they are to that degree idols. And at the end of the day, he summarized this doctrine by this prayer to God. He said, "He loves thee too little, who loves anything together with thee, which he loves not for thy sake." Let me say that again. It's a bit of a tongue twister, but you'll get what he's saying. He's saying this to God. "He loves thee too little, who loves anything together with thee, which he loves not for thy sake." Believe it or not, that actually wasn't the fourth section. That was the end of the third, the transition to the fourth section. So I'm going to have to bury my notes here, but I will just say this. I'll come back to that maxim that's misunderstood, credo ut intelligam, I believe in order to understand. I'll come back to that in another week because there's plenty of opportunities to get into that. But point is, this helps us frame Augustine's definition of faith, his definition of wisdom, his treatment of music. He actually wrote a treatise on music where he talked about the mathematical proportionality of it. And his whole point in bringing this up, in music up, and bringing prayer up and things like that, is to say that everything's in play here. Everything can be an idol or a snare of the devil if we don't look at it in proportion to God, which is what God made. So those are good things, but he made them in proportion to himself. I wish I had more time to get into these charts and graphs and stuff in the fourth point, but I'm always more long-winded than I think. Plus that phone. Any questions? Any comments? Anything? Yep.
So you're talking about realism and Augustine against the Platonists. He says that universals were either attributes of God, mm-hmm, or thoughts beheld in the mind of God.
Yeah.
So what's an example of thoughts beheld in the mind of God that's not an attribute of God?
So there are six people in this room. You could say there are being six in this room. None of those things exist physically. What are you talking about? This room exists physically? Okay, tell me what it is. Let's start. Tell me what this room is. It's four walls. Okay, four. Okay, four walls. Well, the walls, that's the sheetrock right there. What's that? Well, it's particles. What's that? Aha. See where it's going. Okay, physicists finally figured it out, 20th century. Now, they're not giving Christians credit for it. They're saying, well, it's a mathematical formula that stands behind the universe. That's kind of what Stephen Hawking said. But nothing exists physically except, so those 10 categories of Aristotle, everything in existence are one of those 10 categories. Relation, affection, position, time, action, substance is the first one. That's the particular. But if you strip everything away from the particular, all of those things exist on their own. And there's if it's an effect, then that effect is not the essence of that thing. The essence of each thing has to always exist. So it can't be an effect. Okay? So an attribute is so a divine attribute or a divine thought. Nothing else exists in itself. Nothing else has the power of being in itself. As you analyze anything, regardless of what it is, the nakedness of mere things will begin to be exposed. So an example of divine thought would be, so take any sentence and just do, you know, as an exercise, take every single word and start to tear the clothes off. Yep.
I didn't see this and take quotes on 19. I don't know if that's what you intended, but I've been telling the Lord of God that their expanse is playing a word with hand, editing, or sports speech, word, and 99 reveals knowledge.
Yeah.
Because right when you said that, I immediately looked at that verse and then Romans 1, and we quoted earlier. Romans 1 obviously is the one that's showing the attributes of God, and Psalm 19 is the one that's showing his thoughts, because it says those things reveal knowledge. Whose knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
God's knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And him, the communication of him and the experience of his communication of himself, again, is that Trinitarian reflection and everything.
One more thing too. You said words communicate meaning.
Yeah.
Words communicate meaning.
Yeah. So Christ.
The word.
Yeah.
Reveals pure meaning.
Mm-hmm.
John 1.
Yep. And that life was the light of men before the incarnation. The light lit up all men. I really believe at the end of the day that to the degree that, and I'm not talking about people that don't read them in it, but I'm talking about scholars. Scholars, academics that read Augustine or Calvin or Edwards, when they run up against this, what they're repelled from when they're repelled is the bigness of God. At the end of the day, I don't care what issue it is, the thing that is creating the distaste and the, I've gotta refute that. I've gotta get rid of this. I've gotta explain that away. Whatever it is, you pick it. What they're really bumping into and is causing such discomfort is the intoxicating to David. If you read Psalm 139, what's suffocating to them is intoxicating to David. And I believe intoxicating to people like this, to Augustine and Calvin and Edwards. But what is intoxicating to them is suffocating if you don't love what you see in the all-encompassing presence of God.
In my conversations at the men's retreat, one of the guys I talked to liked the diversity of things.
Mm-hmm.
But when you started running big circles,
yeah,
unifying everything together,
yeah,
he repelled at that and wanted nothing to do with an all-encompassing. And he was a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Professing Christian.
Yeah.
But he didn't like our logic classes and everything else that you're talking about right now, but there is one unifying principle.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he believes in God, when you get there logically and philosophically, he doesn't want to admit that that's what's going on.
Yeah. This is why philosophy and logic is banned from the churches. Because all philosophy and logic is doing, in the hands of somebody who's spirit-led and is a theologian, what philosophy and logic does is say, and this means you, and this means everything, and that means period, exclamation point, this means this, that circles over everything. In other words, you're drawing circles around the stuff you're pretending to believe right now, But we're saying, no, that really means that. That equals that. And is it, no, that can't be. Well, I'll accept Jesus, but not really. Okay? So philosophy is just saying, really? To theology.